Coach's Corner with Coach Butch McAdams. And this show is sponsored by Hortons Funeral Service, Dr. Edward T. Buford, and the Athletic Republic Capital Region. And as always, powered by the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. Big props to my producer and the founder of the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. He is Rick Hampton Sr. Well, folks, in the Coach's Corner, another legend, another interesting subject. So without further ado, he was a parade All-American out of Chicago's Mount Carmel High School, second team NCAA All-American, playing for the legendary Coach Al McGuire, drafted number 40 overall by the Milwaukee Bucks in the 1976 NBA draft, played for the Bucks from 1977 to 1980, and then for the Kansas City Kings 1980-81. Currently, he is senior career counselor for the NBA Players Association, where he has logged over 2,000 hours of counseling NBA players. And here's the most impressive stat that I have. He is one of just three NBA players in history to receive or earn a doctoral degree. He is Dr. Lloyd Walton. Dr. Lloyd Walton, man, always a pleasure. I know you're busy, and your time is much appreciated this evening.
Thank you, Butch. Thank you for the introduction. I'm happy to be on your show. Thanks for having me. You know, it's that time, unbelievable, unprecedented time as we're going through now, just with the pandemic, and then obviously with the protesting and what have you, and the end of the basketball season, which we're trying to recoup and get back started. So it's just a lot of things happening right now, a lot of balls being juggled in the air from all the people involved. So I'm excited to be on it. I got time to do it. So let's talk about it.
Well, let's start off. We lost a legend in the game of basketball, but especially an iconic sports legend in the D.C. area, and I'm speaking of Wes Unseld. Your reflections of the Washington Monument, Wes Unseld.
As I was sharing with you, I remember him as the gentle giant, one of the most professional athletes that I've ever played against. His professionalism off the court transcended his accomplishments on the court. He's a Hall of Fame player, but everybody will tell you that played in that era what a professional he was. And the thing about it is kind of the same kind of character that we would like our players to exude today is that professionalism, and it doesn't leave just – it's not just on the court, but it's off the court. And being representative of just where you came from, who you represent, and the game of basketball.
Absolutely. And one of the things that impressed me the most about Wes was that he didn't really care about stats. His main concern was winning. And whether it was getting that extra rebound or setting that pick or getting on the floor and getting that loose ball, he would do all of those things in order for his team to win.
Well, that's old school basketball, but you know that, man, that during the era that Wes played in, and I was part of that era as well, we were taught the fundamentals of the game. We loved the game, but we were taught the fundamentals of the game, and we were taught that it was a team game and that no matter who you were, if you had the opportunity to perform on the court, that you should be prepared and ready to do whatever it took for your team to win. And so that speaks volumes about Wes, but there were very few players that only thought about their stats back then. Everybody mm-hmm. just wanted to win. They wanted to play the game. They wanted to compete at the highest level and do everything they could to win. Guys took pride in setting the pick that you talked about. And I got a couple great stories, and memory served me really, really well. I remember playing with Milwaukee, and we had a guard by the name of Brian Winters. And I remember Wes setting a pick at half court, man. And our center, whoever it was, did not call that pick out. Man, if Brian hit that damn pick, pow, and just slid down West, right? And they had to come get him off the floor. But it wasn't a dirty thing. It was our player's fault who didn't call it. But he was that kind of player. That meant more to him than putting the ball in the basket. And when you think about players like that, man, you have to respect their love for the game and commitment to the game.
Dr. Lloyd Walton, where did we lose that? You still have some players playing today that care more about winning than the stats. But as you stated, that's old school. Where did we lose it? Where did scoring 30 points become more important than getting that W?
Well, as you know, Butch, everything kind of filters down. Behavior of the game, right? Parts of the game. Remember, we used to really be concerned, and we both have heard this many, many times, that players played for the name on the front of the jersey, not the name on the back. Right?
That's right.
I wanted to represent my school, Mount Carmel, right? I wanted to represent my school, Marquette. I think in the early 2000s, when the NBA began to look at having this ability to market not just the NBA, not just the team, but players. And it started in the late 90s when you talk about Isaiah and all those guys, right? They wanted to market. These were great players that they could market all over the world. And so when you started marketing players and you started getting these opportunities because of that, then players began to look at the game as like, I want to play it, but I'm more interested in what I can get off the court, the endorsement, if you will, the commercial, if you will, as opposed to winning the game, becoming a champion, sticking with a team for 7, 8, 9 years, right, where you wanted to put together a culture of winning and professionalism that meant more than the name on the back of that jersey. So I would say probably for me it was like the last of the 2000s, the early 2000s, where David Stern just said, hey, man, we have something very, very special. And I don't believe that he thought it was going to turn into this, but he wanted to market the game and it became a global game. But in becoming a global game, it also became the individual game, if you will. And that hurt us tremendously.
Dr. Lloyd Walton is in the coach's corner. And, Lloyd, as you stated, you were on the court with Wes. It's been so many discussions about exactly how tall was Wes Unseld. Some say if you counted his bush, he was 6'7". Others say he was 6'4". By your measurements, Dr. Lloyd Walton, how tall was Wes Unseld?
Okay, I'm going to say with the throw, he was probably 6'6". Okay, I'm going to give him 6'6". But I saw a picture today of Wes and the Big E. Okay,
mm-hmm. Right.
This picture was taken when both of them were in college. And, man, they look great. But the point is that even then you could see that the Big E was probably like 5 inches taller than Wes, right? But he took up so much space. And one thing that I don't want to slip my mind as we talk about Wes is that when we talk about an outlet pass, there was nobody to this day who could throw an outlet pass like Wes Unseld. And you have today, you know this, man, you have today where people talk about, and he does a great job, Kevin Love. He can throw an outlet pass.
Yeah.
But it pales in comparison to a Wes Unseld, okay? I mean, that outlet pass, man, was always on the money. It was damn near like a Tom Brady pass, man.
That's right.
It was always on the money. He did it with almost little effort, put it right on the money for a guy to be able to create some offense or have a lay-in. So, you know, the bottom line is that we lost a gentle giant and someone who had of so much respect and admiration for the game, and he played that way.
You know, you can never say never in sport, but I will say that it would be nearly impossible for someone, especially in the NBA, to duplicate what Wes Unseld did. I think it was the 1969 season, where he was the Rookie of the Year and MVP at the same time. I don't think we'll ever see that again.
That'd be hard to do, man. That would be hard to do. And it's not like they didn't have great players back then, but to be Rookie of the Year, and considered the best player in the game that year?
Yes.
I'm kind of with you. I don't see that ever happening again. We won't say never, but I don't see it here in the near future. Let me put it that way.
Wow.
I don't see that happening. I don't see that happening at all. No. Uh-uh. Totally dedicated to the game and to his
craft. No question about it. No question. Dr. Lloyd Walton is in the coach's corner. And as I introduced you from Chi-Town, from Chicago's Mount Carmel High School, and I can remember seeing Mount Carmel coming to D.C. and playing in the Knights of Columbus tournament.
Yes.
And they had some strong teams, some great players. Talk about Chicago basketball and Mount Carmel basketball.
Well, let me just really, you know, like going to Mount Carmel was totally different. And Clyde and I have conversations about the makeup of schools in D.C. versus Chicago. I didn't start off at Mount Carmel. I started off at a public school in the suburbs and was giving a scholarship to be educated and play basketball at Mount Carmel in my sophomore year. And so that's how I ended up in Mount Carmel. And you know, it was the kind of school that was predominantly Irish Catholic, okay? I didn't want to wear no damn tie. I didn't want to go to school with no boys, with all boys, okay? So I was pushing back like crazy. And I just have a great family. I was by a tag team. I was raised by my mom, my aunt, and my grandmother. And they just said, hey, this is going to be the best thing for you. Now, as a child, and that's why we have to have great parents, because my parents, they had the vision. I did not have the vision. I didn't want to go. But this guy, this assistant coach who came and found me, he picked me up and drove me to school, which was 25 miles away from my home, and brought me home every day for 3 straight years.
Wow.
And it changed my life, Butch. It's in my book, but it totally changed my life. It gave me an opportunity to look at life a little bit differently, obviously. It allowed me to integrate with other people who I didn't necessarily know, believe in, or understand their culture. And so at the end of that, Mount Carmel, then I became, as you had already stated, a Parade Magazine All-American. And I didn't go there thinking that that was going to happen. Like I said, I hated it every single day. But I got an opportunity to do something that most of the guys did not get a chance to do. And, you know, I left there and, you know, I wind up at Marquette University, somewhere I did want to go. Let me be very clear. I did want to go. Al McGuire, as you know, he was just so damn charismatic. And people oftentimes have asked me, like, well, who would he remind you of today? And I would just say he was a little bit of a combination of Calipari and Krzyzewski. He was very disciplined and demanding, but he was very loose also and let his players have the kind of freedom off the court. Now, mind you, we didn't have no freedom on the court, but off the court, okay? And when I say we didn't have any freedom, if you can remember back then, we walked the ball up the floor and we ran plays every single time. The only way we could have a fast break or push the ball is if we stole the ball. And that was ridiculous, okay? You got 3, 4, 5 All-Americans on your team, and you will not let them exhibit all of this athletic talent that they have. So that was a little crazy. But nevertheless, I never could look back with regret. 3 years as a starter at Marquette, played for the national championship my sophomore year, and had a record after 3 years, and also captained that team of 78-11. Unbelievable record, right?
No question.
I can't look back with any regret. I also went back and got my degree there. So, you know, like, but I look back in retrospect, my family, people around me, they knew what was best for me, and they kind of just urged me and pushed me and guided me to make those steps that I got a great life out of it.
Speaking of Al McGuire, we have a drop to illustrate to some of our listeners who may not remember Coach McGuire, may not remember how, as you stated, how much charisma and how much flash he had. So we want to put this drop on him.
Al McGuire is one of a kind in the college coaching profession, not because of his success, but because of his personality. McGuire has a unique way of expressing himself, and he never wastes words.
A team should be an extension of your personality. And my teams are thoroughly obnoxious and arrogant.
Remember when Al McGuire snubbed the NCAA 2 years ago and took his team to the NIT? Well, today, McGuire told why.
Well, my main reason for going back into New York City was to see my mother. And what happens if I don't get back every 4 or 5 months, my brother John knocks me out of the will. So I hustle back in to pick up some points each time I go back in. Because every time my brother John kisses my mother, it's $500. He's a hell of a nice guy as long as you're not related to him.
In a more serious vein, McGuire told how his son Allie is having a problem with the cut of his white corpuscles and may miss Saturday night's game between the freshmen and varsity. Allie is the team's playmaking guard.
Last year, an interesting thing about my son is that George Fraser, my sixth or seventh man, he probably could start this year with Marcus Washington, came up to me and said, Coach, I should be playing. I'm as good as your son. I said, George, I love my son. And for you to play has to be a clear knockout. It can't be close, you know. I don't believe in this, the old school of beating your son on the head, you know. It's my son, if there's a break to be had, he's going to get it. Then after blood comes the next guy.
McGuire runs his team in what he calls the senior system. He explained how it works.
This is the year we try to take care of Bob Lackey, the kid from Evanston, Illinois. We'd like for him to get a decent pro contract. And I think this is the only practical way of running basketball teams today. As long as you play with one ball. You know, if you play with two or three balls, I can keep a lot of guys happy. But there's only one, and this started years ago with Dean Memminger and George Thompson. I remember George was a senior and Dean Memminger was a sophomore. And Dean would dribble the ball down court, and I noticed George getting closer and closer to him, like trying to get the ball away from him. So finally, we started out that year 2-2. So finally I had to say, Dean, you're a sophomore. George Thompson has done his thing. He showed us that he can get us there. It's George's year. And it's hard for these boys to accept this. Extremely difficult. Because a year to a young person's life is like eternity. As you get a little bit older, a year doesn't really mean that much as far as time element. So this year we'll try to steer all the garbage to Bob Lackey. That will, what I mean by the garbage, you keep them a little bit longer against the cupcakes. And you put them...
That was vintage Al McGuire. Dr. Lloyd Walton, I can't wait to get your response to that, man.
Wow, man, he was so damn authentic. So honest about it. You know, he talked about being an extension. That's the first thing he talked about. His players were surly, obnoxious, and arrogant. I know I was arrogant about it. He had some of us that were, you know, that were obnoxious about it and surly. But we were extension of him. I was his coach on the floor.
Yeah.
And people said that I reminded them, or we reminded them, of each other. But him and I would go at it from time to time. But to think about, I remember George, his name was George Fraser. We called him Sugar. He was sweet, sweet player out of New York. And that's who Allie McGuire, Al's son, was competing against. But what I remember, Bob, what I remember Al telling George Fraser, when George Fraser said, I should be playing, I'm better than Allie. He said, man, you may be better than him, but I got to sleep with his mother. I can't go home and not sleep with his mother, man. So, you know, and then you think about the senior system, which he had. And he talked about, you know, Bob Lackey. He always talked about, guys, when you get to be a senior, I got to make sure I give you every opportunity to be able to demonstrate and show your talent so you can get an opportunity to go play at the next level. That's how he was, man. Obviously, you don't have to do that now because guys are one and done. But just to think about this 30 years ago, for a coach to be able to think like that and to be able to present a proposition like that to his players, it was unheard of, man. It was unheard of. He was absolutely a one of a kind, man, without a doubt. I miss him today, and I'll tell you this, Butch. There was three guys on that bench. It was Al McGuire, it was Hank Ramos, and it was Rick Majerus.
Yeah.
And what I miss more than anything else are my accomplishments after I finished basketball and them not being able to see me, for example, like walk across the stage and earn a doctorate degree. Because if it had not been for them, I probably wouldn't have been able to be on that path to be able to achieve some of the things that I've achieved. And I wish they could have been around to see me really exhibit some of the things that they taught me, make right decisions, right, help other people, and use basketball and not let it use me.
Wow. Dr. Lord Walton in the Coach's Corner. And as you mentioned, great point. I was going to bring it up. When you played for an Al McGuire and you were the point guard, you were an extension of him. And he would allow his point guards to respond back to him. You know, whether it's a Lloyd Walton or a Dean Memminger or Butch Lee, share with our listeners one or two memorable stories with you and Coach Al McGuire.
Well, the one that sticks out in my mind, we're playing for the national championship. Well, we're in the Final Four, and we're playing the semifinal game to get to the national championship. And we're playing against the University of Kansas. And we go in at halftime, and I think we have a 1 or 2 point lead, something like that. Not a big lead. And Al chews into, I mean, he goes after us really, really hard. And I said, man, you know, we got here because of us. We didn't get here because of you. And me and him went back and forth at it, man. And I'm at the point, Butch, you just have to see this. I'm taking off my uniform. I'm like, well, we don't have to play for you, man. We did this on our own. I mean, all this kind of stuff. And then Al had this way of looking at you or saying one word, and that one word or that look meant, okay, you had your piece. Now sit down, shut up, and let's go. And obviously I didn't finish taking that jersey and uniform off. I sat my butt down. I listened to instruction, and we went out and beat Kansas to go to the national championship. We might have beat them by 15 points after that. But that's how he was. I mean, I'll give you another example. My sophomore year, Bo Ellis' freshman year.
Yes.
Maybe our first or second practice, man. Marcus Washington and one of our other role players, Dave Delsman, who was another guard, they get into it, right? They get into this physical confrontation, and people are jumping in. And next thing you know, Al is jumping in trying to stop him and tell him neither one would be a tough guy if he had to fight him. He's the toughest guy. And before you know it, Al and Marcus and Delsman are on the floor, on the court, battling, fighting each other. Hey, man, so this is the kind of stuff that happens all the time. He would always push you to that point to get the best out of you. And sometimes it was not the traditional kind of way to do that. But everybody kind of understood after being there over a year, he understood that this possibility was going to happen, but he loved you. That was the bottom line. He loved you, and he was going to make sure you got that degree.
I look back at the 70s and the 80s, and for me, that was the greatest decades for college basketball because you had people staying all 3 years. They were mature. They understood the game, and it was just great ball. Talk about NCAA basketball in the 70s.
Well, before I did, I want to just tell you about one of your guys from D.C., okay?
This just
came to mind. He went to Notre Dame, and we're talking about Adrian Dantley, okay?
My man.
Because they were independent, Marquette was independent, so we always had this rival war. And I think we always played each other twice a year, home and home, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And AD was on a roll. And I'm speaking, you know what I'm talking about. AD was on a roll in college basketball. So we're going down to Notre Dame to play Notre Dame. We got to figure out who's going to guard AD. You know, so Al came up with this idea that, okay, look, this is what we're going to do. AD's about 6'4" and a half. And about 225 at that point, and he decides to put me on AD. Okay.
For the sake of our listeners, you were what, about 6'1"?
6'1", 150 pounds. Okay.
Oh my goodness.
Looking like a mosquito on a bull, right? So, but the idea made sense, and here was the idea behind it. The idea was Lloyd deny him the ball. Okay, which I was good at because I was quick enough I could get around. If he got that butt on me, you know, I was done. So I mean, that's just true. You know, if he got that post up, man, he got that butt, I was through. So that's the way we played the game. And I would say probably the first half I was very successful at that. And the second half, I want to say that he got the ball where he wanted and did what he wanted. And I would just say this, years later when we both were in the NBA, I didn't feel so bad because I saw him do the same thing to Kareem. I mean, the same damn thing Wasn't nothing special. As you know, Butch, wasn't nothing special. But he'd get that ball on that block, and he was going to either score or you were going to foul him. He was going to the line, he was going to make free throws. And so I saw him get 45 or 50 against Kareem, and I felt so damn good I didn't know what to do because he didn't get 45 or 50 on me, okay? So that's one of the things that I remember about him. But the basketball, as you alluded to, was consistent, and you got a chance to see players really evolve. You got a chance to see a team, right? Because a kid would come in as a freshman, may have been a high school star, but he has not found his, you know, didn't have his footing yet in his freshman year in college. But you saw him get better and better and better, and by the time he was a junior, he was a real player. The other part was that learning curve was so good for college players. None of us knew what the hell we were doing as freshmen, right? But you got drilled and drilled and drilled about the fundamentals of the game. You learned the game. You had to become cerebral, if you will, have that basketball acumen where you understood possession, clock, right, score. You had to understand it and what that meant. So by the time you got to be a junior, you understood that game, and you understood that game where you could be attractive to the NBA and their scouts.
Mm-hmm.
Today,
wow.
Come on, man, come on,
yeah.
Man. I don't care how good you are. 1 year in college is not going to prepare you for the NBA.
No.
Now, having said that, if you just want to run and jump and dunk or run to the corner or run to the three-point line and shoot, then, yeah, you can pay you for the NBA because that's what the NBA is turning to. I call it my horse. My horse, we used to have a game we called varsity, right? Everybody go one-on-one each other on the playground, and you keep the score. One, everybody gets to everybody. So I call it my horse varsity game because that's what it seems to me. You see a guy take 20 dribbles. Butch, you're from D.C.,
yeah.
Man. Can you see a guy taking 20 dribbles in one possession and then launch a shot? Come on, man. That ain't basketball to me, man.
We talked about
West Unseld. We talked about setting that pick, which was just as important as the guy taking the shot off the pick, right? We talked about defense, all those kind of things that make up a team game. Today, there are very, very, very few, one, players that want to play the game from their shoulders up and understand it, and there are very few teams and coaches that demand that they do it. And that's the biggest problem that we have. There's no very few coaches are demanding and have the kahunas enough to demand that they play the game the right way. And that's one of the problems. And these kids start playing like this when they're in high school and that AAU stuff, and then it goes to college, and the college coach thinks he's going to lose the kid if he don't let him play the way he wants to. And so he gets 1 year of that crap, and then he comes to the NBA and think he can really ball out. It's ridiculous.
Man, amen. Amen. You just turn and preach to the choir. And, again, not to paint all of the AAU coaches with the same brush.
Right. Right.
But a lot of them haven't paid any dues. When I was coming up, you had to pay dues to be a coach. You would start at the middle school level or the recreational level, and then you may build up to be a JV coach or an assistant coach, and then if you're fortunate, you get a varsity job. But by the time you get a varsity job, you have paid dues, meaning that you were experienced and you were ready. A lot of these coaches today don't know how to execute a pick and roll or how to defend against a pick and roll. What they do know, Dr. Walton, is they can select five or six top-flight players, give them some gear, and now they're a coach, and I have a team.
And nothing could be further from having a team. And I think, you know, think back when we grew up in our respective high schools and even rec ball and what have you, when we had a coach, coaches were disciplinarians.
Yeah.
You didn't just do what you wanted to do, period. Even in the rec league, man, our coaches were demanding. Like, you're going to play the game this way, and you're going to do it the right way, or you're not going to be on the team. We don't have that now. Holding guys accountable. I mean, I can think about right off the top of my head. So we got Doc Rivers, we got Popovich, I don't know who else right off the top of my head. We got a few others that are real disciplinarians who are not afraid to lose their job, care less about their job. They care about how you play the game. And that's the way our coaches need to be from that level, that AAU young level, all through AAU and to high school and to college. You need disciplinary. Somebody's got to hold you accountable to do the right thing for the right reason. And the right reason is that you're in a team game and it needs to be played in a team way. But it's just unfortunate, man. I'll tell you, you know, my job is working with NBA players, and so I have to go to a lot of the games to see the players about certain things. And I usually choose, but I don't know when the last time I went to see a whole game, and I have a pass. I can go to any arena in the country in the NBA, you know, and get a seat. But I don't go to games anymore like that. I mean, this is my 21st year, and my first 5 years, I never missed a game when I was in the city of Chicago. But now it's hard for me to go and watch longer than a quarter, and that's the honest to God's truth. So sometimes I'll tell the wife, hey, I'm going to leave at halftime, and I'll get there probably right before the fourth quarter, so I'll watch the fourth quarter and speak to my players afterwards. Or sometimes I'll feel good enough to leave early and catch them, which I don't like to do because they're trying to prepare for the game. But sometimes I'll get there, you know, maybe 2 hours before the game, get my conversation with them in and over. And trust me, I am out of there and on my way home before tip-off, okay, because it's just not a beautiful thing to watch from my perspective. And I know the young people love the game the way it is, but I'm old school. I don't make any apologies for it, and I want to see a game played with five players. I want them to space the floor. I want the ball to move, and I don't want anybody to dominate it or take all the shots. So it's very hard for me to be able to watch a game during this period of time.
I would concur, and one of the lost arts that drive me crazy, and you talked about the master of it, AD, Adrian Dantley, post moves, playing with your back to the basket. If someone comes along now, 6'8", 6'9", that can master that, that person can make $30 million. But people aren't teaching it, and why? Because most coaches don't know how to teach it.
Well, I think that one of the things that happened was that we got a little conflated with that European-style basketball with American-style basketball, right?
Yes.
And it appears that the European style won over because we were a physical kind of game here. We were a fundamental kind of game here, a real tough kind of game in America. And then they came in with this, with big guys being able to shoot and dribble and all that kind of stuff, well, along with the three-point line. So it's very, very difficult for me to like this kind of game, as I call it, it's a horse game. Because halftime, ain't nobody guarding you. You shoot behind the line, nobody's on you. But the problem with me with more than any of this is like when you talk about post moves, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, man, when I was going back my first 5 years in the league, I would watch the game really, really closely. And it was hard to find a player, even a point guard, who could feed the post. I mean, they just couldn't do it. And to me, when I taught basketball, I coached at the high school, and I coached at college at Marquette, what have you. I coached at the CBA before it became the G League. You know, that was – I would always tell my players, this is the easy thing, and I'm going to show you two, three things to do where you can feed the post, you know, from the wing or from the top. But you got guys today making $10, $12 million a year who can't feed the post. And to your point, don't have any post moves. They lost. You throw the ball on the block, they'd be like, what am I doing down here with a ball in my hand? They lost. So
that's why I love the Greek Freak, because he is still old school. I mean, he certainly can face the basket, but he can take you down low, and he's got the drop step, he's got the up and under, he can work in the paint.
Yeah, he does. I'm looking at that team and thinking about what they can do. And the only thing I come up with, first of all, I love the Greek Freak. When, you know, Milwaukee is the team that drafted me. I still have a great relationship with their front office and him as well. I'm thinking this, though. Their coach and Buzz, Coach Buzz, has got to figure out a way to get the ball moving, and particularly the Greek Freak on the move. And one of the things the Greek Freak has got to be able to do, because his dog is, you know, so much damn attention when he gets it, particularly when he enters that key area, right? But he's got to be able to find that open man, shooters, when he's double-teamed. Cannot, in that game, that series they had against, I think it was Toronto, maybe Philly. You've got to get him on the move. You can't let him just bring the ball straight down the court. That's not going to work. Let him get the ball up. Tell him to go to the baseline. Let him cross the baseline. Let him come up the middle. Let him do other things where players don't know where he is all the time. It's always easier to follow the guy who's got the ball. You can easily follow him. But that kind of guy, once he gets it, he's dangerous, but he's got to be on the move. But I look at them, and I look at them in the East, and I you know, hey, I don't see why they shouldn't win the East. They're going to have some competition, but they should win the East.
Wow. I tell you, I love talking basketball with folks who know what they're talking about. And we've got one of the best this evening in the Coach's Corner. He is Dr. Lloyd Walton. And what are your thoughts, Dr. Walton, on NCAA players, especially at the big-time level, that brings in millions and millions of dollars, being compensated financially?
Well, as we all know, we have the NCAA is old and antiquated rules and policies which prevent our players from benefiting from their likeness and opportunities. This is utterly ridiculous that you can gain financially on the way I look, and I can't. This is utterly ridiculous to tell me that I can't make a dollar, all, you know, because somebody wants me to, for a speaking engagement, and you show me every week, and you make millions. This makes no sense, and it's been far too long of us doing this to players. And I can't think of what they get now. I was going to say, but I know back then, I think we got 15, maybe 20 bucks, right? That was my meal money, man, you know. That didn't take us nowhere. You couldn't even take the nicest girl to go get a hamburger, right? But then you on TV every week, and now they got cable, so you might be on TV twice a week, right? And they tell me I cannot be the beneficiary of the way I look, of my autograph, speaking engagement, all of those kinds of things. It makes no sense whatsoever. And I think we have to do everything we can on every level to be able to push back against the NCAA taking advantage of our young kids, because that's what they're doing. They're making millions and millions of dollars each and every year off the backs of our kids.
As I mentioned, as a senior career counselor, what are your thoughts on, you had talked about the one and done. Dr. Walton, if I were king for a week, King Coach McAdams would have a rule that if you were good enough, if the scouts and the general managers wanted to draft you straight out of Carmel, Mount Carmel, or DeMatha High School, or Dunbar High School, then so be it. But if you do decide to go to college, you've got to stay at least two seasons. Agree or disagree?
Well, let me say this. I disagree, and here's the thing that I want kids to be able to do. And this is a tough one for me, Butch. I mean, really, really tough one for me, okay? Because I've seen the casualties. So I just feel like when you turn 18 years of age, you can go to war. You can buy alcohol. You can buy cigarettes. And you can do all those kinds of things. Then why can't you make a decision about your livelihood and a career? They allow golfers to do it. They allow tennis players to do it. The only sport that I don't think you can do that is with football, because you're talking about bodies not completely developed at that point. But you should be able to make that decision. And I say that with a great deal of trepidation, because I have seen players who would leave after even that, back there in 96 and what have you. Remember, we were letting them right out of high school, right? So I saw players who would put their name in the draft, and then they wouldn't get drafted, and they couldn't go anywhere to college. They went right back to mama's basement. They had no career. They had no skills. That's what I'm always fearful of, because at the end of your career, at the end of the regular day, what do you bring to the table besides a jump shot, besides a layup? can that carry you for the rest of your life to be self-sufficient? And most guys, it cannot do that. But I like guys being able to make their own decisions. You shouldn't tell me that I can't make my own decision if you could send me to war. At 18 years of age, we're playing basketball. I should be allowed to do that. Now, I think after the casualty phases that we will go through, then guys will take a better look and have more discernment about what the possibility is of them being able to make it. So they don't have to go back to mama's basement. They can make a decent living. And just a side note here, as you know now in the G League, they signed a couple of these can't-miss guys, right? They're going to make $500,000 a year, okay? Here's the real deal with that. So you get $500,000? No, you don't get $500,000. You get, because of taxes, you get about $275,000, $250,000, right? So you ain't at $500,000. Now, financial literacy is going to be critically important to this young man and to his family. Because everybody can't live off of $275,000 if you're going to go out and buy cars and houses, okay? Because what if you don't make it the following year to the big leagues, to the NBA? That was your break. You didn't go to college in that 1 year. So I'm really, really concerned about the lack of financial literacy and the lack of a guarantee to make any money after 1 year. Because that money's going to be gone, man. It's going to be gone quick. And it's not the kind of money as if it was like $30 million that you could live off of for, you know, for 10, 15, 20 years. That money's going to be gone, man. $275,000. Hopefully it'll get you through 2 or 3 years, if that. So...
Yeah.
I'm a little concerned about those kinds of things with our young players. And, you know, when you have all these people around them, and I'm not, as you said, I'm not painting a broad brush over guys who are around, whether they're directly, whether they're with AAU. I'm not saying that. I know we got some great guys to help them and what have you. But we also have some guys who are not so great. And they're looking for something to benefit. They look for guys they can benefit off of. And so they benefit when you go because they feel like they fed you the ball every year or 3 or 4 times a week. They should get a piece of the pie. I'm fearful for those guys not making it, and I want them all to make it. You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful life if you get a chance to make it. But if you don't, what are you going to do, man? What are you going to do? How are you going to become such self-sufficient? You know, how are you going to have a family? How are you going to be able to take care of them? You know, we're talking about a high school diploma. That's all you got, and you got to have more. So that's my fear, man. That's really just my fear of it, and I want these guys to be successful on and off the damn court, because it's a possible way for you to really be something special when you can do that.
As I mentioned during the introduction, Lloyd Walton was drafted 40th overall in the draft. And talk about Lloyd Walton being drafted into the NBA, and now Dr. Lloyd Walton being a senior counselor and advisor to NBA players. The question is, from a player's perspective and from a life coach / senior counselor's perspective, what are some of the major adjustments that these youngsters have to make coming from college to the NBA off the court?
Okay. I got to give you a side note, too, about being drafted, okay? So I'm at Marquette. I told you what a great record we had over a three-year period.
Yeah.
And God rest his soul, but Jerry Krause was actually a gopher for Arthur Morris, who was one of the big-time agents back then, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he was courting me like you wouldn't believe probably for 3 straight months. This is Jerry Krause.
Right.
2 weeks before the draft, he gets the general manager's position with the Bulls. Now, in courting me, he's telling, that means he's calling me on the regular in my apartment and what have you, and he's telling me that, you know, you're going to go in the late first round, no later than the first picks of the second round. So my hopes are high, man. I had a great college career, so my hopes are high. And he gets the job with the Bulls, but he doesn't pick me. I mean, I'm pissed. He drafts Willie Smith out of Missouri. But there was somebody else who also gave me the idea that they were going to draft me. And his name was Bob Ferry out of Washington, was the Washington Bullets.
That's okay? Right.
Told me, you know, he didn't tell me he was going to pick me. I don't want to lie on it. But gave me the feeling and the idea that he was going to draft me. And they needed a point guard. And he drafted Larry Wright out of
Georgia. Oh, yeah. Yep.
Okay. Let me tell you, man, every time I saw Willie Smith and Larry Wright, my eyes lit up. And all I could think about was your so-and-so is mine tonight, buddy. But here's the crazy part about it is that Willie Smith was out of Missouri. He did not even make it out of training camp. Okay? They got rid of him. The thing about Larry, he was there and always had this thing about whenever I went against him. But my vet when my first year with Milwaukee became Bobby Dandridge. And Bobby Dandridge talked his way, acted his way out of Milwaukee so he could go with he wind up with the Bullets, right?
That's right.
And so so Larry was around for the championship, and all I could think about, that should have been me, damn it. That should have been me. But in regards to our young players coming into the league, first and foremost, they have to know that this is a business. You must that must be ingrained into you that this is a business. And the owner of the business has invested in you. And in any investment that you make, most of the time you want what is the ROI. What is the return on my investment, right? The second part of that is, what does it mean to be a professional basketball player? Not a high school player, not a college player, but a professional basketball player. That means that the majority of your time and your resources should be geared toward developing your skills to become the best basketball player that you can become. And it's really, really difficult for young players to understand it because they think they're back in college and so they're going to go practice for a couple hours and they're going to be done. No, 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 no. You need to get there early. You need to stay late. You need to lift weights. You need to get a chef, a nutritionist. You need to do all these things that make you a professional basketball player to be able to hone your craft so you can give this man a return on his investment so he can invest more money in you. And when you don't, then you don't last very long. The other part of it that young players have to realize is when you come into the league, you're going to be challenged by guys who have to pay mortgages and private school fees, and they're not going to give their job up lightly. You're going to have to earn some respect, okay, because this mortgage is costing me $6,000 a month, okay? I got private school with three kids. That's $4,500. You know, I got to make sure that you coming in here, you know, breath smelling like Similac, you think you're going to get my job and my wife is on my butt, she want a new this and a new that? It ain't going to happen. And when you do that, you have to understand the last and final thing is that I'll say is that you're not in college anymore, and the plays for most, for 97.7 of guys, we ain't getting ready to run no plays for you, dude. That's just for that 3% guys we're going to run plays for. You're going to come in and have to learn how to set a pick, what we talked about earlier, how to be able to get the ball to the right guy. Okay? We don't need you to score. You know, you ain't that good a score. Man, we're in the pro game now. Somebody's going to be guarding you. You're not going to be shooting free. So when you do those three things, in my mind, you set yourself up, one, to make it, and two, to have a decent career. Our decent career now averages 5 years. That's a short period of time. But I think, guys, today, if you do the right things, you could easily play 8 years in this league, and you could leave with enough money to be able to transition into the next phase of your life and live a very good life with you and your family. Because, you know, let me just say this too, but the average salary is $7.7 million. Can you imagine that? I don't knock role players because I was a role player. But you can be a role player and make between $7 and $10 million a year, dribbling the ball, passing the ball, shooting the ball. The same thing I was getting on some guys that's here in Chicago. They all in their 50s, and they talking about having a training camp. So now you talking about guys who ain't some most of them ain't played in the NBA ever, but they talking about having a training camp. And here these guys, young kids, can go and have a training camp and make $7 to $10 million a year. It's unbelievable, man.
It is, yes, it is unbelievable. how, share this information with us, because a lot of folks are not aware. How long do you have to play in the league to be eligible for a pension, and what are the numbers for pensions?
Well, you have to play 3 years. There was just an unbelievable infusion into it about 4 years ago. I will say at the highest, if you play 10 years, you probably will be able to get $6,000 to $7,000 a month for the rest of your life, which ain't bad money if you can get it.
No.
Right?
That's right.
Ain't bad money to be able to sit home. Plus, you think about those guys who were able to play 10 years or so, even if you played 8, but if you played 10, think about the money that you already made. And then you're going to be able to get this, you know, this $6,000 a month, right? From juggling the ball, I've had a couple friends who said their whole life, they're in their 50s now, they seen that they ever earned, they earned because of the game of basketball. This thing that we started playing out on the playground, remember? We were at school and they had a ball and they said, hey, it's gym class, go through down, here's the ball. And now everything that this guy has earned, it's two or three of them, everything that he's earned has become is because of a basketball.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I tell you, I'm enjoying this so much, this visit in the Coach's Corner with Dr. Lloyd Walton. And Dr. Walton, it appears that of all of the major sports leagues, NHL, Major League Baseball, NFL, the NBA seems to be the more progressive. We do have a black majority owner in Michael Jordan, and I believe down the road that we'll have another. If a LeBron James chooses to go in that direction, I think he could become a majority owner as well. Talk about blacks not just doing the labor aspect, but going to the front office and all the way to being the majority owner.
Well, there's a couple of things I think about when you know, in thinking about that. I think the reason why we are so progressive, as you alluded to, is that our players have guaranteed contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So when if my money is guaranteed, I feel very comfortable in saying what I want to say and taking a stance, right?
Mm-hmm.
The other part of it is that it's really, really true, and people realize it, that nobody ever says they're going to turn on their TV or go buy a ticket to go to an NBA game to see the owner. They come to see the players. So I think that players understand the platform that they have and the strength that they have. I think our players over the last 10 years have really seen the opportunity available to them that they can have more power and they can create their own narrative and the direction of their life. There was a point in time, as you know, and I think about guys who walk in the locker room the night of a game and they done traded this guy. He ain't playing no more. They done traded him somewhere else. And the guy will not sign you to a contract, you know, because of some petty kind of thing. Those kind of days are kind of gone. Players can basically kind of call their own shots. And that means so much to be able to dictate what your career is going to look like and how you want to live, which has led our players to be able to infiltrate other industries, other levels of business, right, becoming owners, creating their own documentaries, if you will, creating companies, if you will. And I did get a chance to watch a little of PG County. Is that it?
Yes.
Yes, I did get I got a chance to watch a little bit, and then the wife came in. But I got enough to watch that I know exactly what happened, but I'm going to watch the end of it. So, but to the players, from the players' perspective, it's like I can do almost anything that I want to do in terms of ownership. I have the capital. The only thing I have to do is to be able to become better as a businessman to be able to use the capital and not throw it away. And so they do that on a smaller level. They start out, and it just grows. They become smarter. They become more exposed and more involved. And I agree with you. We're going to have another majority owner, I would say, within the next 10 years, if not sooner. I'd like to hope to see it in the next 5, but certainly in the next 10 years we'll have one.
Absolutely. Let's talk about guys and their responsibilities to speak up on social injustice, police brutality, etc. Kaepernick took the stand by kneeling. LeBron James, he has been, I'm not going to compare him to Muhammad Ali, but he has been one of the more outspoken and activists in sport in terms of top-level celebrity athlete. But talk about, from your perspective, does a player have a responsibility to use his or her platform?
Well, I'll start with this saying that to whom much is given, much is expected. And sometimes it's demanded. Now, that's the saying, but I don't necessarily agree with it. I think you have to be educated about what the topic is.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to be passionate about what the topic is, and you have to be comfortable in terms of sharing your perspective about the topic. Everybody can't do that, you know, and it's not fair for us to demand any particular player to do that. But it's also great for those players who have the capacity to educate themselves, to understand what the topic is, and to be able to speak intelligently about it, because we get such a joy out of being able to support that player because he's doing something that we know that people are going to hear, that if the everyday guy would say it, nobody would care, right? So when LeBron says, I can't breathe, when LeBron says, I'm not going to shut up and dribble, when LeBron says, I'm going to open up a school for kids in Akron where I grew up, when LeBron says, I'm putting 2,000 kids through school, we know what that means to our families and our community. We know that. In the depths of our soul, we know what how wonderful, how beneficial that is to us. Now, the other part of that is that we have a number of players who do things, and it's their own decision, who says, I'm going to do it, but we cannot have any media there. I don't want to be bothered with the media. I don't want to be answering no questions. I'm doing this out of the goodness of my heart. I want to fill a void that I recognize in the community in which I came from, but I don't want to do it with the media. And that's their choice, too.
Sure.
And we shouldn't think less of them, because what happens is that when a player does not speak out, a high-caliber player doesn't speak out, people think they're not doing anything. And I'd venture to say, as you've already shared with your audience, this is my 21st year, so there's nobody that I haven't worked with in 21 years. Everybody does something. And our high-caliber players, they do more than you could even imagine.
Let me interject this, having said that. I have always said that some of the criticism of Michael Jordan not doing this, not saying this, I think has been unfair. And you can confirm or deny, being in the league for so many years and also being a Chicago-based guy, Michael Jordan does a lot on the low. Michael Jordan has hired a lot of people that look like him. He's written a lot of checks for organizations that look like him. True?
Well, not only am I a Chicago guy and been in the league a long time, I worked for Michael for 3 years.
Okay.
When Michael's dad was killed, the Bulls built a family life center in honor of him, named it James Jordan.
That's right.
And they built it from the ground up. And the Bulls and the Jordan family selected me as the first executive director of that facility before it was even complete. And Michael put $2 million of his own money into that venture. It gave resources, activities, and opportunities to a community that basically had nothing. I think it really is unfair. You know, when you're a high-caliber guy, think about this, man. If you're a high-caliber guy, most of my guys are high-caliber, have been in the media's eyes since high school. Can you imagine how many interviews, how many talks, how many cameras have been in their face? And you get to a point where that's not even important anymore. I just want to do, I'm going to say God's will, but I just want to do humanity's will, right?
Sure.
I want to do humanity's will. I want to make somebody else's life better because my life has been so good. And so players choose to do that. They just don't want to do it with any fanfare. And so I do think it's unfair. And, you know, most of the time the criticism comes from people who don't even know the player. They have no idea what that player does, right? And
absolutely.
It's so unfair. You know, nobody said a whole lot when Michael just opened up. 2 years ago, he opened up this damn medical clinic, you know, in Charlotte for people who couldn't necessarily get any services because they couldn't get to the hospital. And it was, you know, man, it was subcontracted so they can get these medical attention. And it wouldn't cost them anything. And, you know, I mean, guys do all kinds of stuff, man. It's just crazy to think that players that come from our communities, think about that. Most of the guys that they want to criticize come from our community. How can you forget what community you came from, man? Jesus, it's crazy,
yeah,
man.
I would agree. Two last points. We talked about how progressive the NBA is with a black majority owner and the possibility in the next 10 years or less of having another. But also there's a strong possibility, I want you to speak to this, of having a head coach female.
I think we're very close. I would venture to say, because I think we have, in that second and third seat, I think we have four young ladies in those third, the second and third seat, right? And they're coming. And here's the beauty of it to me, okay? They're not giving that a pass. They're earning it, man. They're earning it. They're earning the respect of the players. And that's what they have to do. So I'm looking at probably within that five-year period, we're going to have a woman head coach in the NBA. Absolutely. Without a doubt. And they're going to be just as good as the men are. Because it takes work. It's not like it's going to be easy. And it's not going to be especially easy for them. They're going to have to earn it, but I think they're going to be good. They're going to be up for the task.
Do you think, how difficult would it be? I've heard some people say, well, it would be difficult, and then others are saying, well, no, if the woman knows the game, then it won't be that difficult. Because so many of the players were reared by women, mothers, grandmothers, aunts, that they're used to taking directives from women. Talk to us about that.
I think it would be difficult just because you'd be the first woman head coach. And let me just say this, these guys are pushing back on men coaches. These guys are pushing back on men coaches who played in the league. So it ain't like they ain't getting ready to push back. And even if you have this little period where they see you as, you know, Aunt Mary, that's not going to last very long before they're going to want to know, okay, because players that used to be tell you what to do and you like, go do it. Now they want to know why. So these young ladies are being prepared to be able to tell them why and demand respect and hold players accountable. They understand that. And I think, like I said, I believe they're going to be up for the task. But it's not going to be easy. It's not easy for any player. Even if you play the game, it's not easy for any of them. The thing that you get, but there's a little bit more respect because you played the game.
Mm-hmm.
But if you played the game and won, you get even more, right? But that don't mean you're going to be good. Look how Magic was. He wasn't good at it. Zeke wasn't necessarily good at it. One of the best ones that was good at it was, to me, was Larry Bird. Was a hell of a coach. So it's going to take, you know, there's going to be some ups and downs with it. That's the bottom line. So
yeah,
nothing comes easy.
As a young man, 24, 25 in Washington, D.C. in the 70s, and I was broke compared to the NBA, young NBA players, but you're a young man, you're going to do things the young men do.
Mm-hmm.
How do you advise 25-year-old, millions of dollars in the bank, playing in Atlanta, playing in D.C., playing in Miami, with so many beautiful young ladies and clubs? How do you balance the two, man? How do you advise these young guys?
But first of all, man, let me just say this. You know, I tell these guys that we have what we call rookie transition program every year where we bring all the rookies in. And one of the things I tell them about, and we laugh about it because I say, you know, when you got drafted, actually your family felt really good about it and they looked like they were going to have a really good future. But let me just tell you this. The women put a label on your forehead, and the forehead says ATM. Okay, now, along with that forehead that says ATM, you got so much more handsome now than you were before you got drafted. And some of you are going to actually have opportunity with women that wouldn't give you the time of day 2 years ago.
That's right.
I say that you need to be always safe, number one. Number two, you need to always do something that will not embarrass your mother or your sister. Remember, you have both of those, and do nothing to do that. And I'm not saying don't enjoy yourself. Have all the fun in the world. We all did. But there are limits, right? And you don't want to break any laws, period. The other part is that, man, most of you all have a financial advisor who's going to give you the script, which means how much money you're going to have cash per month, how much are you going to have on your credit card. Just like you follow your coach, follow the damn financial advisor, but also have somebody in the cut who's following him, okay?
That's right.
Yeah, you know, you got to have to make, because, you know, some of these guys will just talk numbers to you and they'll talk all over your head. Don't ever let anybody do that to you, you know, and that's another whole story, but
sure.
You just got to know that your opportunities have grown exponentially when you get drafted, and everybody is going to want a piece, okay? And they're going to come at you full bore, and you have to at least say, well, it's always good if you have a relationship with God, okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you just remember that you playing the game, that's all. You're just a basketball player, but that's not who you are. You're just playing ball. That's not who you are, man. And you want to have some money in your future. You know, you don't have to have every new thing that comes out, okay? Because if you try to do that, you're going to be broke. Because they're going to come out with something new every year. Some people come out with something new every 6 months. And try to live within your means. The greatest teacher, I'll just say this last week, the greatest teacher I ever had about money was my grandmother, God rest her soul, who died in 96, but she wasn't rich, but had more money than you could ever believe, working a job and being an entrepreneur, making those plastic covers back in the days that they used to put on furniture.
Sure.
Everybody always would come to her and ask could they borrow some money. Because she knew she used to pick cotton. She wasn't getting ready to spend no money on a whole lot of junk. All she needed to have was a food and a roof over her head and money in case she needed it.
That's right.
And that's the bottom line. She was the best one I ever had in terms of a budget, man.
We've got about 6 minutes left. One of the most impressive things doing our conversations off air, when you told me that growing up, you did not want to be known, but first and foremost, as a basketball player, that when you were in high school, that your buddies would introduce you to people, introduce you to young ladies and say, well, this is my friend Lloyd, and he's a great basketball player. Yeah. You didn't like that. You frowned on that. Just talk to us about that. We've got about 3 minutes.
Okay, I don't even like it today, and my wife gets on my case. So, you know, the thing about it is when I was a kid, when I was growing up, I never knew during that introduction when my friends would say that if this person really wanted to get to know me or really liked me, because they had already prefaced it with something that I did that everybody didn't do, and that was play basketball. So I didn't know if this interaction was going to be genuine or not. And I've carried that for the rest of throughout my life. My wife and I were talking about this maybe last week, and we talk about it often because she gets on my case if we go out somewhere and somebody will come up and reference me as a basketball player. And, you know, I acknowledge that, but I cut that short. I ain't trying to talk about basketball, something I did 30 years ago. I'm just not about that.
Yes.
I'm about what I do now.
That's right.
What I'm working on, what I'm thinking about. If I leave this earth, Butch, and people only know me and remember me for what I did with a basketball, I've fallen short of what God wanted me to do and be. And I believe that with all my heart. That's why I went back to school. That's why I'm finishing my book. That's why when people call me, I'm willing to help, because there's so much more to me than basketball. Basketball was great to me. I've used it to have a great life. But there's so much more that I want to do and that I'm doing. And if you only see me as a basketball player, then you're selling me short, because I'm far more than that.
Wow. 2 minutes, please leave our listeners. We call it wow, words of wisdom. With this world and this country being upside down with the pandemic, social injustice, police brutality, etc., leave us with some words of wisdom, Dr. Lloyd Walton.
Okay, this has been on my mind a couple of days, so I'm going to do this real quick, and I hope that you will appreciate it. Declaration of Independence says very simply in this one paragraph, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with a certain inalienable rights, that among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And what sticks out to me is that they said all men are created equal, and we are all created equal, but we're not treated equal, okay? This implicit bias that we see from particularly white people, and there are some good white people, we're not talking about all of them, this implicit bias that says to them that they should hate me, that they're entitled to more than me, that they are privileged, is a fallacy. It's not true. And I want to have a conversation with all of my white friends about why you hate me when you see me. What makes you think you're better than me? And how can we close the gap with this conversation? And it's an honest conversation that I put out to have with all my white friends, because I'm tired of living a fallacy. I have 3 sons, but more importantly for me, I have 4 grandsons. And I'm really concerned about the life they need to live, because I know them as very young, caring, loving, compassionate young men. And I don't want them to have to be affected by the life that I've had to live over the last 50 years.
Dr. Lloyd Walton, if this were a baseball game, this would have been a walk-off grand slam. I have done a number of interviews during my career, but none more enjoyable, none more informative, and none better than the one we just had. And I'm going to tell our mutual friend, Clyde Travis, who I grew up with on 14th and T Street Northwest, and of course he's been in Chicago longer than D.C., a Hall of Fame sports writer, high school Chicago Sun-Times. I'm going to tell him that if you are as awesome on the golf course as you were on the basketball court and in the coach's corner tonight, stay home. Don't even try.
Thank you for those kind words, Butch. I really appreciate it, man. I have thoroughly enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you. And, folks, that was Dr. Lloyd Walton. And boy, what an interview. What an interview. Up next in the coach's corner will be Donald Duck Williams, Mackin High School, Notre Dame, and the NBA coming up on Thursday. But I want to thank our sponsors. I want to thank Horton's Funeral Service. They're located at 600 Kennedy Street Northwest. You can give them a call at 202-829-9000. Again, that's 202-829-9000. And ask for Randolph Horton, my brother, a.k.a. Reds Bowman. And also, any dental work, don't you hesitate. Ask for Dr. Edward T. Buford, 202-667-8818. And I want to thank, as always, my super producer, Rick Hampton Sr. Thank you, my brother, for making this show possible. And, of course, this show was powered by the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. Well, as always, make good decisions, because life is hard, but it's even harder when you're stupid.
You'll listen to a 30-second demo. Go premium to download the entire file.